Sticks and stones may break bones, but words always hurt. Welcome everyone to our JCC Lunch and Learn, my second opportunity to be part of this wonderful, wonderful program here at our beloved JCC of the Wyoming Valley. And thank you everyone for coming out today. It means a lot to me personally, and I'm just excited to be here. So today I want to explore words, the power of words. And I believe that at the end of today, hopefully, if I achieve what I'm hoping to achieve, we will have laid out for ourselves a new and different, perhaps, understanding and appreciation for what words truly are capable of, and our responsibility, therefore, to use them wisely. Let's begin at the beginning. Source number one, Genesis chapter 1, verse 3. God begins the Genesis project, creates the world, and remarkably, he creates our world through dibur, through amira, through speech. Now, of course, he's God, so it's not an issue here. But God conceptualizes the world, and every component of creation is created through speech. Most famously, the first time God uses speech, and God said, "Let there be light." Boom. There was light. Vayomer Elokim yehi or, vayehi or. So we see that the creation of our universe, of our world, is with speech. It's not a small issue. And let's now fast forward in the creation process to day six. Day six, we were created, mankind. Let's have a look. God says on day number six, "And the Lord God formed man of dust from the ground. Vayitzer Hashem Elokim et Adam afar min ha'adama." And what did he do? It says he breathed into mankind's nostrils the soul of life. Nishmat chayim. Neshama, soul. And man and woman, became a living soul. Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, the great Torah commentator, Rashi, the medieval Torah commentator, who is the first source for understanding our Bible, our Torah, says the following. What does it mean he transformed man with the breath of life and that man became a nefesh chaya, this living entity, this living creation? What does it mean? Have a look. A living soul. Well, cattle and beasts were also called living souls. So what differentiates us from them? But this one of man, this creation, is the most alive of them all. Why is that? Because he was additionally given two things that no other creation was given. Intelligence, da'at, and dibur, the power of speech. And so while the Yankee, the parrot of the world, may parrot words, we are the only creation capable of, number one, self-awareness, the intelligence to create both mentally and then physically. And of course, speech is a huge component of that, as we've already witnessed with God's creation, and as we'll see today. Now, we are currently in the fourth book of the five books of Moses, what we call the Chamisha Chumshei Surah, the five books of the Chumash. Every year, of course, we have a cycle that each and every Sabbath, each and every Shabbat, we have a Bible reading, a Torah reading, what they call the Parsha of the Week. We are immersed in a book called the Book of Numbers because the first couple of sections deal with the mustering, the numbering of the Jewish people, the calculations of the math. But really, the word B'midbar is written sans vowels in our holy language, Lashon HaKodesh, the holy language of Hebrew, biblical Hebrew. So therefore, you could read the word B'midbar in terms of the desert. All these stories take place during the 40 years in the wilderness. But you could also have a little play on words and say that the word B'midbar could be read B'midaber, It's all about dibur. It's all about speech. Midaber, to speak. And we see, and as we'll see today, each and every episode seems to have a speech component. This last week, on Saturday, we read Parshat Bahalotcha. And at the end of this parsha, Miriam, older sister of both Aaron the high priest and Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, she speaks against Moses. This is the first and defining instance in our Torah, in our Bible, where someone speaks what we refer to commonly as Lashon Hara, evil speech, bad speech, or literally Lashon Hara, speech of the evil. Good has a speech, it has its own language, apparently evil has its own language. And what did Miriam say? Now we need to understand what she said, because it's so critical to understanding our own usage today of how we utilize the power of words. But before we do that, I want to point out in source number 3 that in Deuteronomy we go back to the story from this past Torah reading, from this past Saturday, Shabbat, and we reiterate that it's not enough just to have the story once a year, but that each and every day of your life, there is a biblical requirement, according to some rabbis, that you must remember the story of what happened with Miriam and her brother Moses, and you must recite it and remember it each day. We have what they call the 6 remembrances. There are 6 separate times in the Bible where we are told to remember something. For example, the most famous would be Zecher Liyitziat Mitzrayim, remember the Exodus from Egypt. That's one of them. You have to remember the Shabbat, the 4th of the 10 Commandments. Keep Shabbat holy. It says Zachor, remember Shabbat. Zachor, remember what the evil Amalekites and Haman tried to do to you, his ancestors on the way out of Egypt, the Amalekites. One of those 6 is to remember what Miriam said and what happened as a result to her. Let's read it. It says, remember what Hashem your God did to Miriam, Zachor 8, Asher asa Hashem Elokecha le Miriam, Baderech, on the journey, on the way, Betzeitchem Mimitzrayim, when you left part of the Exodus from Egypt. So it's a requirement to remember each and every day. Why should this be so? Okay, it's one thing to talk about speech, the creative power of speech, but that each and every day, now there are some Ashkenazic Jews in the world, and if you look at your Siddur, your prayer book, you may see it there. At the very end of the morning prayers, it lists the 13 attributes of God, what we call the Yud Gimel Ikrim. We have to believe as Jews in 13 principles, you know, that God is omniscient, he was, is, always will be, he has no body, Moses was the greatest prophet, etc. And right after that it says 6 remembrances, and some people say them every day at the end of their prayers in the morning. Big thing. So why should this be so important? So let's understand what Miriam did or did not do, and why, and try to understand the perils of speech. Okay? So I put a source for what happened. But you need a little context, a little background. In last week's parsha, you have a unique situation. Moses cannot handle the complaints of the Jewish people. You know, the complaint department was just overrun, voicemail. He couldn't handle all the negative publicity and the negative harangues of the kvetching of the people, right? You know, Jewish people, kvetchers we are. Famous story, you may have heard this, where Rabbi is walking by and he sees a little boy playing with his dog, and the little boy looks and recognizes the rabbi. He says, Rabbi, he says, I want to show you how smart my little dog Yankee is. He says, Yankee. And he picks up a stick, and the little dog makes eye contact with the stick. He says, I want to show you how well trained he is, Rabbi. And he throws a stick down the beach, and the dog he looks at him, he says, come on, Yankee, fetch the stick for the rabbi. So Yankee stops. And he looks up at the little boy. He says, it's hot out here. I'm always being sent to get a stick, and then I bring it back to you, and then you throw it somewhere I'm not. What's going on? The little boy says, Yankee, says to the dog, I told you to fetch the stick. What's with you? He says, fetch. I thought you said to kvetch. Kvetching is a part of who we are. In this last week's parsha, yet a lot of complaining. And Miriam, believe it or not, complains against Moses. Now, what's this a response to? So apparently, these two great prophets, one named Eldad and one named Medad, were given prophetic abilities by God. They're prophesying in the camp, which was technically against the rule. The wife of Moses, the gracious, lovely Zipporah, daughter of Jethro of Yitro, happens to be standing there next to Miriam. And Zipporah makes an offhand remark to Miriam. She says, you know, I feel sorry for these newly crowned prophets, Eldad and Medad, because in my situation with Moses, my husband, you know, I don't see him again. He went up Mount Sinai and he just never comes home again. He's not a family man. And I'm sure the same will now happen perhaps with Eldad and Medad. Their wives are going to become widows to prophets. So Miriam hears this comment. She thinks to herself, oh my gosh, but wait a minute. I'm a prophet. My younger brother Aaron, the priest, he's also a prophet. We live normal family lives. What's with Moses? What's with my baby brother Moshe? What's going on? And so she goes to Aaron and they start talking about the situation. And they actually go to Moses himself and they confront him with this accusation. How come you're different than we are? We're all prophets. How come you don't live as a family man? You're like a monk. You live an aesthetic style of life. It's not proper. How come you kind of divorced your wife Zipporah? We haven't. What's with you? Now Moses could have responded, but he doesn't, out of his humility. God steps in and says, Miriam, really? You're going to talk against Moses, my servant, my faithful servant? He's so humble, he won't tell you the reality. He's never shared to you the reality. You guys are run-of-the-mill prophets, you and Aaron. You think you're hot stuff. You're really on the lowest pedestal of prophetic abilities. You're not very special. I communicate with you the way I communicate with all other prophets in this world. I give you riddles and dreams and visions, and you kind of have to be in a trance-like state. And you're always the receiver. You're never the one who initiates the communication with me, God says. But not Moses. Moses has to be 24 hours, 7 days a week ready, because I come to him anytime, and he has to be ready to go. He can't be unclean from marital relations and such. He has to be ready to go. And not only that, but el pe adaberbo. I communicate with him face to face. He can even pick up his cell phone, should he have a question for me, and dial me up and say, God, you know, I got a problem. I got the daughters of Slachad here, and they want to know, can a woman inherit the land of Israel if there's no husband? Huh? What say you? Oh, they're right? Thank you. Okay, daughters of Slachad, that's the rule. Moses could do this. And I mean, that would be kind of neat to have a Verizon cell phone plan with a G-O-D, you know, instead of 911, you dial G-O-D. I think that would be a very valuable plan. So don't speak against Moses. Now Miriam and Aaron are immediately visited by God as they're with their collective spouses. And they realize, oh my gosh, I have to speak to God. I got to go to mikveh. I got to get washed up. I got to be pure. And they're like desperate to speak to God. And God says, see what it's like if you were living a family life, how hard it would be if I visited you and asked you to talk to you. That's what Moses is like. So don't dare criticize Moses. And so we know that that's sort of what happened, that Miriam is struck with leprosy. Sarat. It's not real leprosy, because when you have real leprosy, you go to Dr. Cohen. You don't go to the Cohen himself, right? I mean, what does a Cohen, a priest, know about diagnosing a malady, right? You go to your doctor. So you go to a Dr. Cohen, but apparently you don't go to a doctor when it comes to biblical leprosy. You go to your Cohen, your priest of choice, and they diagnose the situation. So what is the main cause of this biblical leprosy, which does not exist today? It was bad speech, Lashon Hara. And of course, it makes a whole lot of sense, because the leprosy impacts a tiny section of your body. Little white blemish on your skin precedes it, the whole body becomes unclean. That's exactly what we do with words, right? Because when we malign somebody, the person may be totally 99.9% healthy, and we like them. But there's one little issue that we hone in on, just like the leprosy hones in on one tiny segment of the body, and that defiles the whole body in terms of spirituality, which is exactly what you did to this poor person that you spoke ill of. Now, let's get back to Miriam. What is scary about Miriam, and I believe, is the source for the biblical requirement, as we said, Zachor. You got to remember each and every day the perils of bad speech. Why is Miriam the paradigm? Why is she the archetype for this? Because think about her unique situation. You could not write out a better script of someone who loves someone more than Miriam loved Moses. Now think about it. She's 5 years old. Her mom and dad in Egypt divorce publicly. And her dad and her mom are the leaders of Jewry in Egypt pre-Exodus times. Okay? So Yul Brynner is still lurking around there as the Pharaoh at that time. So what happens? Little 5-year-old Miriam goes to dad and says, "Dad, your decree by divorcing mom is worse than Pharaoh killing the Jewish babies." He says, "What do you mean, my daughter Miriam?" "Well, you know, you're killing by divorcing mom men and women from ever being born. Who are you to decide what the future will be? At least Pharaoh's only killing the boys, not killing the girls." So he thinks about it and says, "You know, Miriam, you're right." And he publicly weds his wife Yocheved, remarries her. All the men remarry their wives who had followed after their leader's model. And of course, what happens 6 months later, not 9 months, because Moses was a premature baby. 6 months later, Charlton Heston, you have Moses. Moshe Rabbeinu is born. So Moses doesn't even exist without Miriam and Miriam's vision for a redeemer, correct? But it's better. Who waits by the Nile River as the little basket with little baby Moses goes into the water and the alligators and crocs are floating around, you know, until princess of Egypt, Basia, daughter of Pharaoh himself, comes walking down by the water. Who's watching the whole time? Miriam. Miriam's there the whole time. So you cannot script a more loving relationship between siblings, Miriam towards Moses. So therefore, you cannot say that her choice of words against Moses had any malicious, malignant component at all. Yet, she said the words. No intent to hurt, only to help. What was her mistake then? I believe it's very simple. That she's human, like we all are. And as human beings, we only see what is in front of us now. The immediate. We may know a snippet of our own past. We may have read books and seen movies of other people's interpretation of other histories and pasts. But we're very limited in our scope. So to comment about something the way Miriam commented about Moses' own family situation is totally inappropriate. Because how could you know? The fact is that Moses hid his own greatness from his siblings out of humility. And as I pointed out this last Shabbat, it's so ironic that when people malign other people for a shortcoming, you know what the case usually is? Not only is it not a shortcoming, it's usually a person's strength. Moses was maligned, and not only was it not an issue of why he was separated from his wife, Zipporah, but it was his greatest strength, his humility, that defined him, that he wouldn't even allow himself to say to his own siblings, "Hey, I might be a step up on the prophecy level than you." No, he wouldn't even say it. God has to defend him. So therefore, what is the lesson? It's a very sobering lesson. Only God has ultimate perspective of what's going on in our world. We can never have that perspective. And no matter how well-intentioned you are, like Miriam, and how loving you are, be careful, because your words have the power to kill and destroy. We saw our world was created with speech. We uniquely have been bestowed and given this amazing gift of speech. It has a duality, the potential to empower someone, to praise someone, to lift someone, to elevate someone. Just a good morning and a smile can just, on a, like that, snap of the finger, you could take someone who's on their way to throw themselves off a bridge out of despair. And through your show of kindness and love, just a little smile and a good morning and a well wish, you can save a person's life. Or, conversely, God forbid, you can destroy a person's life with words. That's why we call this sticks and stones, because as children, we always say that. Well, sticks and stones, but you know what? Think back to your own youth. You don't think of the bruises that you could never recount for me, the bruises you had from playing with friends. Could be, though, I'm willing to bet, if you really thought about it, there might have been a mean boy or a girl who said a despicable comment against you about the way you dressed, the way you smelled, the way you talked, whatever it was, that can stick with you and define you for your life. So it is baloney to say that words don't define and shape a person. They're much more injurious. And that's why I always point out, you know, little boys are not verbally skilled like women are. And I remember as a fourth grade and sixth grade teacher, I would see this. I was stunned. You know, at recess, if the boys have a little bit of a disagreement on the playground, it usually ends in a pushy match or a shoving match or a ball being thrown at someone's head. And I know who's the guilty or whatever. I know who the suspects are. I bring them in. Girls are much smarter. I remember watching this. Girl's handing out a paper. She walks by this little girl's desk. And under her breath, I didn't hear what she said, but I saw the result. This little girl broke down in tears, who she handed the test or whatever it was to. I'm like, what? And all it was a little tiny offhand remark about the hairstyle or the wardrobe or whatever it was. But that poor little girl was just shattered by words. So very often, boys can't compete verbally at a young age, right? We only catch up later, maybe. And what do? We lash out with physicality. That's the sticks and stones. But the words, oh my gosh, words are really powerful, very injurious. Let's turn over our sheet. Here's the problem. We now have a complete understanding and clarity, I hope, of the perils, the dangers of words. The capability to destroy or to create universes, literally, not just metaphorically. But here's the problem. If Miriam, who is the greatest lover of Moses, was capable of negative speech, Lashon Hara, and she's punished for this, and she's held up for all generations as the paradigm of what not to emulate, how should we deal with words that we want to speak? So one might think, rightly so, here's the answer. Never speak or listen or even give an audience to someone about to utter words that are negative about somebody else. Because clearly, if it's a bad thing, if it's a negative to either speak or be an audience to someone speaking badly, then it must be the way we repair the damage is what? The opposite. Close our ears. Refuse to engage. But we're going to see in a moment that that's not actually a response that is in keeping with reality. It's much more difficult for us to deal with words. Now, there is a fast day. It's a very, very strange fast day. It comes out the day after New Year, Rosh Hashanah. And it's called the Fast of Gedalia, Tzom Gedalia. And a lot of people don't even understand, why are we fasting? Okay, fine, I had too much challah with raisins, you know, and I had too much apples in my honey, so obviously it makes sense. It's a preparatory fast to get ready for the big fast in 7 days called the Day of Atonement, Yom HaKippurim. But we kind of just gloss over this day called the Fast of Gedalia. Fast of Gedalia is actually connected to the destruction of our temple. And as we're going to see in a moment, and I hold up the whole story here, but I'm not going to bore you by reading it. That's for later for you to take home and read it. I'll tell it to you outside. But it's going to show you an amazing thing. That Lashon Hara, evil speech, cannot be dealt with in simplistic terms. And that's why I believe we struggle with this each and every day. You're going to hear how crazy it is. So let me recount to you a story from Jeremiah, Yirmiah, the prophet Jeremiah. So in the book of Jeremiah, we are subject to a story that takes place right in the aftermath of the destruction by the Babylonians of Temple Number 1. So we're talking about 586, approximately, it's debatable, before the Common Era. So, you know, 2,600 and something years ago, going back. King Nebuchadnezzar from Babylonia destroys our temple. Most of Jewry are taken captive, those who survive, and are taken back to Babylonia. But a she'erit, a remnant, are permitted with full authorization of King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylonia to remain in the promised land of Israel. Not a small thing. Now, some Jewish people had run for the hills when the Babylonian army was striking Israel. They knew that no one could stand up to King Nebuchadnezzar's army. So what they did is they hid in adjacent lands, Egypt, Moab, Ammon, the adjacent territories, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, Syria, what they are today. They waited to see what would happen. So what happened is the following. Jeremiah, the prophet, comes and he says to Gedaliah, the son of Achikam, you are the handpicked by King Nebuchadnezzar and by God, leader of Judah, of Israel, anyone who's still alive and living and who chooses to live here. And Nebuchadnezzar has authorized me, Jeremiah says, to tell you the following, that God said this is good. Stay in the land of Israel. Take care of the land. Plant. Sow the seeds. Cultivate the soil. Make your lives here. I know it's been difficult, and I know without a temple in Jerusalem it's going to be hard. And I know you're down. But God has a divine plan. Stay. Okay. And everyone comes to pay honor to Gedaliah, the new governor. You can't call him the king because it's really King Nebuchadnezzar. He's a surrogate for the king in Babylonia. And everybody comes, including a man named Yishmael and a man named Yochanan, who are great warriors, leaders of the armies. They all come. Everyone kisses metaphorically the ring of the Gedaliah. They accept his preeminence. But all is not well. Why? Because with every interpersonal relationship, you have ego, right? Not everyone's like Moses, who does not have ego. So this guy, Yishmael, not a happy camper, because he's descended from royalty. And he thinks to himself, huh, Gedaliah was chosen by Nebuchadnezzar to be the leader? Huh, what about me? Passed over me? And at the behest of King Bilas, a neighboring king, who does not have the best interests of the Jews at heart, Bilas convinces Yishmael that he's the rightful heir to the title of governor of Judah, leader of the Jewish people. Now, Yochanan, the other great general, comes to Gedaliah and he says, Gedaliah, got a problem here. This guy Yishmael, he's coming to have a meal with you on Rosh Hashanah. I know you invited him. He's coming to assassinate you. He's coming to murder you. You cannot let this happen. Because if he kills you, we're all finished. If you're chosen by Nebuchadnezzar, when he hears that his handpicked successor is murdered by another Jew, it's over. So you can't allow yourself to be killed by Yishmael. Gedaliah stops in mid-sentence and he says, you are speaking Lashon Hara? You're speaking badly about this Jewish man, Yishmael, descended from royalty? We just lost a temple because of garbage coming out of people's mouths like you. And you dare to speak garbage against this man, Yishmael? We just lost our temple. It's still burning in Jerusalem. And you're speaking like this? I will not listen or accept this report from you. And he leaves it at that. Yochanan's not done. He takes Gedaliah aside, out of earshot of all the men. He says, look, I understand you're worried, it's political, you don't want anyone else to know, but it's okay, just between you and me, wink, wink, how about you just kind of give me the thumbs up, quietly, no one else has to know, I shall go with my men, I'll take care of the problem, okay? I have some good hitmen available, I'm number one, and I'll take out Yishmael. Nobody will know that you gave the okay. How's that? Gedaliah's furious, throws Yochanan out of his palace. New Year, Rosh Hashanah comes. Beautiful meal. Yishmael comes with 10 men. They sit down for a gorgeous New Year, dipping the apples, the honey, the challah, the whole thing. And of course, what happens in the middle of the meal? Yishmael gets up. His 10 men get up. Sounds like something from a TV, some show, you know, some almost Lear or Hamlet or something more modern. And they all take out their swords and they cut down Gedaliah. They cut down every one of Gedaliah's men. They even massacre and kill the actual Chaldeans, the Babylonians, who are representatives of the great Nebuchadnezzar himself. Everybody they kill. Everyone. After the meal's over, a day or so passes, and another horrific story happens. These 80 men are coming to see Gedaliah. They don't even know that Gedaliah has been assassinated. Really, nobody knows yet. No one's tweeted it or emailed anybody, so the word's not out. And they come. And unfortunately for these 80 men, they meet up with Yishmael and his 10 murderers. And they say to Yishmael, "Hey, we're coming to see Gedaliah." And Yishmael looks at them and says, "You guys just, like, what happened? You tore your beards, your clothing." They said, "We were on our way to Jerusalem. Nobody told us Jerusalem is burned and destroyed." And so in response to seeing the destruction of Jerusalem, they rent their garments. And they're devastated, these poor 80 men. "We heard that Gedaliah's been appointed to take care of things. We're coming to see him." "Oh, you want to meet him?" Yishmael says. I'll show you Gedaliah." This is not good, by the way. Okay, this is like, you know, the Godfather stuff. You can meet Gedaliah with the fish." So he takes the 80 men, kills them all, and throws them in a pit. And then Jeremiah says the unthinkable. He says the men that came died because of Gedaliah ben Achikam. And so, of course, the rabbis go ballistic. They say, "Gedaliah? He's already been dead for a couple of days. He's the good guy. It was Yishmael who murdered these poor 80 guys." "No. We credit their deaths to Gedaliah." What? Let's step back for a moment. First of all, it doesn't mean, God forbid, Gedaliah is to blame directly. Because that's clearly Yishmael's intent to murder, and it's all on his head. But there's a small component of the story that has to be, unfortunately, credited to something Gedaliah did or did not do. So let's retrace our story for a moment. Yochanan, the hero, comes to Gedaliah and says, "You need to take care of the problem of Yishmael. It's coming to murder you. You can't allow yourself to be killed, or it's all over. And by the way, as a result of Gedaliah's murder and the murder of all the henchmen of Nebuchadnezzar, every Jew in Israel ran away, because they knew that when Nebuchadnezzar would get wind of what had transpired, it would be all over. For 70 long years, the only time in Jewish history, 70 years until the story of Purim, when we come back with Ezra and Nehemiah and rebuild the temple, 70 years pass where there's no Jewish presence in the Holy Land. It's the only time. And it's right at the foot, of course, of Gedaliah's assassination by Yishmael. So, but wait a minute. Yishmael murdered him. But when Yochanan came to Gedaliah, he said, "I can take care of this for you. You don't have to be assassinated. In fact, just give me the wink, and I'll go preemptively strike. Just tell me I can do this." He says, "No." Not only does he say no, he says, "How dare you even offer to speak badly about this wonderful, righteous tzaddik, this Yishmael?" So what's the problem? Did you see the problem? We lost a temple because people were not careful with how they spoke. They spoke Lashon Hara. Right? And this is Gedaliah's, this is his mindset. We just lost a temple because people said garbage about other people. Now you're saying garbage about someone else? I will not hear this. But it still causes destruction. In other words, the antidote, the remedy for never accepting or listening to Lashon Hara cannot be the opposite extreme of, "Well, you spoke it, I will never hear it." It can't be. So what is the answer then? Oh my gosh. I thought the easiest answer should be, don't do it. No, because Gedaliah should have heard the Lashon Hara. Well, but what should he have done? This is the difference. You see, information, my friends, is benign. It's information. How you process it and how you utilize that information, that makes the difference, every difference in the world. You know what Gedaliah could have said to Yochanan? "Yishmael's coming to murder me. Really? I don't believe you. I'm sorry. He's a tzaddik. He's a righteous individual. He would never do such a thing. But I understand what you're saying, and I understand the gravity of the situation. I can't allow myself to be killed. So all he had to do was hire a couple of Secret Service agents to stand next to him at the banquet. Nunzio will stand on the right of Gedalia and Guido on the left with their little earpieces and Uzis ready. And if Yishmael asks, well, what's with the guys? What's with the 6'8" bodyguards? All Gedalia had to say, look, I'm the head. These are my guys. They stay with me. Please enjoy your meal. Nothing has changed. Welcome to my palace. So what's the difference? He didn't have to believe the Lashon Hara to take precautions to protect himself. That's the difference, the utilization of the information. You don't have to fully believe what someone tells you. So if somebody comes to the priest, the rabbi, the policeman, the lawyer, there's abuse going on. Oh my gosh. You don't have to indict the one being accused of the abuse. But you may not sit idly by and let the abuse, God forbid, continue. If it is, you have to take precautions, correct? You have to protect the child, the wife, whatever the issue is. You can't say, well, I won't. Don't believe it then. Don't believe it. But put bodyguards there to protect. So there are two different issues. It's the handling of the information that makes all the difference. It's a huge challenge for us. It's a daily challenge for us. Because information in today's day and age, it reaches us in so many different ways. You know, when we were very, very young, it was usually just a newspaper on our doorstep. Doesn't apply anymore. I mean, there's instantaneous pictures being sent in videos where a policeman could do this, and 4 minutes later, 8 million people will see what a policeman did or did not do. And we know that, of course, an 8-second video can show this but not that. We don't really know the context, but that's the information era that we live in. So now, more so than ever, I would offer, you don't have to believe, but you need to be a thinking person to take the information, to sit back with that information. If, God forbid, someone's life potentially is in peril in any way, shape, or form, you need to take action to protect that life. But it doesn't mean you buy in until the person's had their day in court. A person should have a right of defense. It's not fair to malign and just to step back. Look what they've done to our beloved Israel. The world, right? Just will throw things out there, pictures, accusations, and they don't prove them. They just throw them up against the wall. And all right, 6 months later, a commission's going to come out and finds that there was no massacre in Jenin. It was the biggest lie of the war that they fought back in Gaza. Remember, I don't know if you remember, there was world condemnation. Palestinian Arabs said that we massacred the entire population of Jenin. When they went in there, Amnesty International, not exactly friends of the Jewish people and the Israelis, you know what they found? Nothing had happened. But guess where that got coverage? Oh, I don't know, New York Times, Section E, page 84 in the back, a little retraction. Sorry, we didn't mean to accuse Jews of genocide. But nobody sees that. So we live in an information era. My blessing, my hope for all of us is that we should continue to use information wisely, to understand its potential for destruction, and always use it for blessing, to elevate, to motivate, and to inspire others. Thank you for today.